Those speakers turned out to be much quieter than I expected. Turned up all the way into the red over there and all the way up on my phone. So I guess that's what I get for never having taught in this classroom before. Making assumptions about this. So welcome to this afternoon's session here on this Wednesday of Pepperdine Bible Lectures 2017. Where our topic for today and the next 2 days is the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, I'll be teaching today and tomorrow, and Dave Bland, you're in the same time slot here on Friday. And my task is more of the exegesis of Ecclesiastes, and Dave's is more on teaching from and preaching from Ecclesiastes. But full disclosure, David and I have not corresponded very much about this, only briefly, and so just how cohesive those two sections are going to be, I don't really know. Also with us today is David Holmes, who will be keynoting tomorrow night
on
Ecclesiastes. and David and I have talked a little bit about Ecclesiastes, but we have not tried to coordinate what I'm doing here with what he's doing tomorrow night. So I think we're largely simpatico, but our emphases may be a little bit different. Our terminology may be a little bit different, and that's just going to have to be okay. So for any of you who do not know who I am, I'm not sure if I said what my name was. This podium has no shelf, so I'm sorry if I drop things and have to bend over and pick them up. My name is Chris Hurd, and I am one of the Old Testament professors here at Pepperdine. And I've been thinking about Ecclesiastes for a long time. I really first encountered Ecclesiastes in ninth grade. And really, I don't think I had ever heard much preaching or teaching from Ecclesiastes before ninth grade. The youth minister from my home church, Travis Moore, is here, and he's aiming to change that with our high school students. And when I moved to a new church in ninth grade, to a new city, and when I arrived, their high school class was in the middle of a fairly in-depth study, in-depth, you know, by high school standards, of Ecclesiastes. And that was something that kind of awakened me to the possibilities of rigorous Bible study. Ecclesiastes was the focus of my Hebrew readings class when I was going through my master's degree in Abilene, and the first scholarly article that I ever published was about Ecclesiastes, although it doesn't ever get quoted by Ecclesiastes scholars, so it must not be very good, but that's okay. The truth is, I feel fairly fraudulent doing this because I'm not really an Ecclesiastes scholar. I've been thinking about Ecclesiastes a lot for a long time. But it is not really my main area, and the literature, the group that it belongs to, the group of books, sometimes called wisdom literature, you know, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Songs, that's also not really my specialty. I really ought to be talking about Abraham or Isaac or Jacob or Joseph, because my real specialty is narrative. And what I was really trained for in my PhD was reading ambiguity. So maybe there's some overlap there with the book of Ecclesiastes. So I'm going to do the best that I can here, but I'm not necessarily going to be trying to review or offer you sort of the latest and greatest thinking about Ecclesiastes. If you're somebody who reads every new Ecclesiastes commentary that comes out, well, you may find my thinking to be uninformed by those latest books or something like that. So I just apologize in advance to you in that category. And another thing I want to say right up front and semi-apologize for, I don't know if I should be apologizing for this, but I feel self-conscious about it, Larry, and that's that there's going to be a lot of Hebrew in today's class.
What?
I don't know any way to really avoid that when doing Ecclesiastes, because the problem is if I just open up an English Bible and I start teaching Ecclesiastes directly out of an English Bible using the vocabulary right there on the page, what's happening is that I'm making a lot of assumptions, and in fact, I'm ceding my ability to make informed judgments about what Ecclesiastes is doing to whoever translated it. And there's a lot of terminology, some very important terminology in Ecclesiastes that is hard for us to render into English. And it's ambiguous in certain ways that are hard to reproduce in English. So I'm going to have to talk some Hebrew at you here in a few minutes. And I hope that I do it in a way that's accessible to everyone. But if not, you know, just throw stuff and then we'll be all right. But to imitate the structure of the book of Ecclesiastes, what I would like to do is begin with the conclusion. And so here is the conclusion. This is not the way Ecclesiastes puts it. This is the conclusion of this particular take on it in this particular class. Here's what I think, if I were to put Ecclesiastes in a nutshell, here's how I might put it. Now, I've gone over and over this this wording time and again. I've changed it a dozen times, and I might change it again. Who knows, you know, by the end of class. But for right now, here's the conclusion. Don't tie your happiness to the future. Don't tie your happiness to the future. All right, so if you want to fall asleep now or leave or whatever, you got the conclusion. The rest of my 2 days of this class is intended to show you why I think that that is what the speaker in Ecclesiastes is getting at. And there's going to be a little bit of meandering, and there's going to be some lists and stuff like that. And in some ways, I am trying to imitate the literary structure of Ecclesiastes and what I'm doing. And in some ways, I'm just still confused about certain things and not sure the best way to sort of organize them. Now, I would also like to say that I will be referring to quite a few specific passages. So I do invite you, I see some of you already have your, thank you, Paul, for having your Bible open. And quite frankly, the more translations, the merrier today. So if you happen to have a Bible with you, I do invite you to go ahead and turn it, go ahead and open up to Ecclesiastes. And I'll be asking, I think, for the audience participation here in a few minutes. So here's what I think the outline of today and tomorrow is going to look like. We're going to start by laying some foundation, some vocabulary foundation here for the first few minutes. That would be today. And then the second big portion, if you're doing this in Roman numerals, Roman numeral 1 is kind of laying some foundations with some of the vocabulary that's used. Roman numeral 2 is the problem with life as our speaker sees it. Not by our speaker, I don't mean me, I mean the voice that's speaking to us out of Ecclesiastes. So, part one, some introduction, which is basically around what the project of the book is. If you think about the book, you know, if you go down that hall right there, you're in the science division, and, you know, scientific inquiry often starts with a problem that you're trying to solve or a question you're trying to answer, and Ecclesiastes is kind of laid out that way. So, first is the research question, second is the findings section, that's today. Tomorrow, the recommendations that the speaker makes about how to respond to the findings. That's where we'll start tomorrow. And then I'll have sort of my own comments and postscript about the speaker's recommendations, because I think we have to take what he says and put it into the bigger context, always keeping in mind that our speaker lived long before Jesus Christ, and that makes a large difference in the way we hear the book, as opposed to somebody who was living also centuries before Jesus Christ. So let's launch right now to part one, the project of the book. What is our speaker trying to communicate? But before, I guess maybe even before we get to that, I need to distinguish two voices in the book of Ecclesiastes. Two voices. And what I mean by that is, if we can look at Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2. Let's start almost right at the beginning. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2. Now, I happen to have with me, as my English translation in front of me, I happen to have the Common English Bible. What other translations might be represented here today? Anybody have a King James version with you? Anybody bring a King James with you? No King James people here. Okay, everybody got an app where you could have a King James? Might be fun. Anybody have a New International Version with you? New International Version represented? New Revised Standard Version? Anybody have that one? I'm just curious. It's not a requirement. What other things do we have? What other translations do we have represented here?
The New Language. New Living.
Right. New Living Translation, NLT. Okay. New Living Translation. What else?
NIV.
NIV, okay. NIV, anything in the NIV family should be very similar. NIV, TNIV, any of those kind of things. Yeah. NIV 2011.
Did the Contemporary Message do Ecclesiastes?
Yes, I think so.
Well, I don't have it.
But you don't have it. Okay. All right. Well, this is the wording. Whatever you might happen to have in front of you, it's going to be a little bit different potentially because there are two keywords in chapter 1, verse 2, they get translated in very different ways in certain different translations. But that's not the point just yet. Chapter 1, verse 2 reads this way in the Common English Bible translation. Perfectly pointless, says the teacher. Perfectly pointless. Everything is pointless. Okay. Footnote or preview, I'm going to argue that this translator is wrong. That pointless is not what the author is trying to say. Okay, but for right now, what I want you to do is notice there's two voices that speak in that verse. Two voices that speak in that verse. There's a voice that says, perfectly pointless, everything is pointless. And there's another voice that says, quote, says the teacher. Okay, so we have the words of the teacher, according to this translation, embedded within a report from somebody who's not the teacher. All right, so I'm going to refer to that voice that's not the teacher as the reporter. Okay, I'm going to call him the reporter, or her, I don't know who it is. There's no clues to tip off that individual's gender. There is for the teacher's a guy. The reporter, who knows? So I'm just going to call the reporter. Okay, and I'm mostly not going to talk about the reporter today. But the reporter's voice is the voice you hear in chapter 1, verse 1, introducing the book, and in chapter 12, verses 9 through 14, concluding the presentation. And very briefly in chapter 1, verse 2, in chapter 1, verse 12, maybe chapter 1, verse 12, in chapter 7, 27, and 12, 8, where the reporter just kind of inserts a little comment like says the teacher, like quote says the teacher. Those words are the most common words the reporter says until you get to the end of chapter 12. Okay, so now that we know where to find the reporter's voice, let's ignore the reporter's voice until mostly tomorrow and focus on the other voice, the voice that addresses us throughout most of the book, from 1-2 all the way down to 12-8, except when the reporter pipes up to say, says the teacher. Okay, and most English translations will call this individual the teacher, as the CEV does, or the preacher. And this, NIV, is that preacher? They use preacher or they use teacher? I think King James, I think, uses preacher. Any other translations represented here today? What do you have, sir?
ESV, preacher.
ESV uses preacher. Okay. Anybody have a translation that uses something other than teacher or preacher?
Yeah.
American Standard uses the preacher.
ASV uses preacher.
Yeah, the Message uses quester.
Message uses quester. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, well, this is, a teacher and a preacher, those are similar things, but they're not exactly the same thing, and so there's clearly a little bit of ambiguity here as to exactly what this person is. So, this is my first opportunity to share with you the beauties of the Hebrew language. The two things I teach most often here are introductory class for first-year students and our Hebrew language class, and so I'm really excited to get to share this Hebrew language stuff with you. So, these words, teacher and preacher, quester, whatever else might appear in different English translations, these are all attempts to render a Hebrew word that sounds like Kohelet. Okay, Kohelet. And if you've never heard that word before, I'm going to actually go ahead and write this on the board right here, except that that's too pale for you to see. Well, let's try red. There we go. Kohelet. Okay, now, that's not going to be on the test, but Kohelet, this word, comes down to us through Greek. As this gets moved into Greek, it becomes Ecclesiastes. Right? So the name of the book is also the name of the voice that's speaking to us when you take this into the Greek and Latin versions. All right? And so then that comes down to us as a preacher or teacher. So it's very rare these days to hear anybody use the term Ecclesiastes as the name of a person. So if I reserve myself to using the term Ecclesiastes as the name of the book, nobody's going to get confused. Do you agree? Is that okay? All right, so if I say Ecclesiastes, I mean the book, not the speaker, not the person. Okay? Now, the terms teacher and preacher are they're good enough, but there's a good rationale for them, and the rationale is twofold. One of the rationales is etymological, which is that these three letters right here, the Q, the H, and the L, that's kind of your Old Testament version of ekklesia. And if you know any Greek, ekklesia is the word we translate as church. So the Ecclesiastes in the Greek version, that kind of implies the churchman, the church official in some way. So that's why we get preacher. That's one of the reasons we get teacher and preacher. Another reason that we get, well, let me say this. This word, though, appears to be built. Oh, by this word appears only in Ecclesiastes. And there are several such words that appear only in Ecclesiastes. So either the speaking voice here or the reporter made this word up just for this special purpose of naming this person who is speaking to us in the book of Ecclesiastes. And they appear to have made up this word from these three letters, which... as I mentioned, if you take the noun and you take it over into Greek, you get ekklesia. But if you take the verb has to do with gathering things. And so let's look at our second passage we'll look at here real quickly is over in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. We're going to hear the voice of the reporter for just a moment. Listen to the voice of the reporter from chapter 12, verse 9. Additionally, because the teacher was wise... He constantly taught the people knowledge. He listened and investigated. He composed many proverbs. The teacher searched for pleasing words, and he wrote truthful words honestly. Right? So this raises for us a couple of possibilities about what this person is gathering. Maybe this person is gathering. Maybe they use this term to say that this person is gathering people, summoning people, assembling people together for the purpose of study. This comment also suggests the possibility that maybe we should be thinking that what this person is gathering is knowledge and information and wise sayings and teachings. And that he's compiling all of those things together to be studied. Now, if either of those is the spin that we put on this particular root word, then the phrase teacher or the term teacher or preacher becomes obviously very appropriate. For what we're doing, and we could argue, you know, if we wanted to, about which nuance is better for which nuance. It's not that important for our purposes this afternoon. But I do want to acknowledge that even though these are reasonable ways of approaching this question of what this person is gathering, there's another clue that we don't want to overlook, and that is in the speaker's self-introduction. So if I hop back now to chapter 2, we're going to now hear... this individual speaking for himself, describing himself. And in chapter 2, this individual describes some of his own activities in this way. I'm reading from chapter 2, verses 7 and 8, and it's in a larger context that has many similar words around it. He says, I acquired male servants and female servants. I even had slaves born in my house. I also had great herds of cattle and sheep, more than any who preceded me in Jerusalem. I amassed silver and gold for myself, the treasures of kings and of provinces. I acquired male and female singers for myself, along with every human luxury, treasure chests galore. So the speaker's introduction... suggests maybe that what the Kohelet gathers is stuff. That he gathers stuff. That we might refer to him as the consumer, the shopaholic, maybe even the hoarder. Right? Now, these are two very, very different kinds of things. The resonance you get from what a reporter says about this individual in chapter 12 and what he says about himself in chapter 2, they are both obviously very appropriate to the idea of gathering. But what's being gathered is very different in those two passages. And so, in order to hold both of those pictures in my mind as I think about this person, I have chosen just to call the guy the gatherer. The gatherer. And not try to resolve what it is exactly that he's gathering. He may be gathering different things at different times. Maybe he's gathering stuff, you know, Monday through through Friday, and he's gathering people on Saturday and Sunday. I don't know. But I'm just going to call him the gatherer, which has the virtue, by the way, of being the most literal way you can translate this word into English. Right? Much more literal rendering than teacher or preacher or questor or anything else. So I'm going to call him the gatherer for purposes of our class here today and tomorrow. Now, sometimes I might slip and just call him Kohelet, because that's what I'm really used to doing in talking with my biblical studies colleagues. So if I do that, you know, again, throw a tomato and everything will be okay. So I do this to try to respect both of those clues. Right. By the way, I had a joke written in my script that I forgot to say, which is that since he may be gathering people together and he may be gathering stuff together, maybe we should call him the televangelist instead of the preacher. All right, maybe not. So let's find out what the gatherer is trying to do in this book. But before we find out what the gatherer is trying to do in this book, I am so glad that Fallon walked in at just the moment she did, because the question I need to ask you right now, I need to make sure everybody knows what a hashtag is. Is there anybody in this room who does not know what a hashtag is? Everybody knows what a hashtag is. Fantastic. Because the rest of today's class is about the gatherer's hashtags. All right? The gatherer's hashtags. So, the gatherer tells us straight up at the beginning of his speech, in this book, in chapter 1, verse 3, so it's one verse into his speech, he tells us straight up what it is he's looking for. What I'd like for you to kind of imagine the bulk of Ecclesiastes as the gatherer's Pinterest board. Okay, the gatherer's Pinterest board, because largely what happens in this book, this is not the only thing that happens in this book, but a lot of what happens in this book are little sketches, little vignettes. Today, you know, it would be cell phone pictures that we had snapped, to which the gatherer appends certain hashtags. He labels them in certain ways, right? And what he's doing is he's on a quest to find vignettes that he can label with a certain hashtag, and the hashtag that he wants to use is Yitron. All right, why do I not just give you the English? Because it's ambiguous. It's not altogether clear what he's doing with this. Right? Yitron. In chapter 1, verse 3, in my translation, the CEV here, what do people gain from all the hard work that they work so hard at under the sun? A more literal translation of the sentence structure would be, what gain do people have from all the work that they work so hard at under the sun? And the Hebrew word for gain that's translated here as gain is Yitron. Now, Yitron is like Kohelet. It is a word that appears only in this book. It appears to have been made up by the gatherer as a special hashtag for him to mark situations that he's looking for. He finds four. In his whole life of investigation, he finds four situations that he can mark as Yitron. And at least a couple of these are really hard for me to understand what he's talking about. So he doesn't really succeed in his quest. He wants to make Yitron a trending topic, and he fails because he can't find situations that that qualify. Now, Yitron, we'll probably have to come back to this somewhat tomorrow, but this is based on a root that has to do with things that are left over, like the remainder in a division problem. Or in economics, the net profit as opposed to the gross income, okay, or the gross receipts. The surplus, the thing that survives, the thing that remains, what has staying power. Well, it did not become the trending topic he had hoped for. Instead, he finds that he has to tag all these vignettes with a different word. And the word that he uses more often than any other to tag the events and the vignettes that he records in his investigations is a word that some of you will know. It is hevel. Again, that's the Hebrew form. We'll talk about English here in just a minute. 37 times he tags something as hevel. 4 times he tags it as Yitron. And 5 times he tags not Yitron. Twice he tags it as no Yitron. And 3 times he just asks, what's Yitron? So this is clearly outweighing, hevel clearly outweighs Yitron in the book. So let's find out. In chapter 1, verse 2, I read it a while ago, the CEB says, perfectly pointless, says the teacher, perfectly pointless, everything is pointless. Now, in your translation that's right in front of you, there's a decent chance that the translator used a different word other than pointless. If I remember correctly, NIV, you have an NIV, sir, it's like meaningless. Is that the word that the NIV family used? NIV family uses meaningless, CEB uses pointless, the KJV family uses a noun, vanity. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, is the way I memorized this in ninth grade. Any other translations among us for the end, that climactic word in verse 2? Pointless, meaningless, vanity, any others?
Utter futility.
Utter futility. If you read the commentaries, you will find other suggestions. Enigmatic, absurd, ephemeral. I can't remember all of them.
Smoke.
Smoke. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. What translation is
message.
That? This is the first time I've ever complimented the message. The world is coming to an end. Oh, my.
Yeah.
That is beautiful. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. All right. So this word is clearly a little bit hard for translators to get their hands on and to get their minds around. And it's because, it's for a few different reasons, and I don't necessarily need to dig too deep into these reasons. But one is because we're struggling to find a one-to-one equivalent between a Hebrew word and an English word. And if you know more than one language, you know that can be difficult to find a one-to-one correspondence between a word in language X and a word in language Y. And that's certainly true between Hebrew and English in this case. A second thing is that translators and commentators have an abiding tendency to try to de-metaphorize Kohelet's, or the gatherer's language, to translate his metaphors into direct, straightforward discourse. And that is, I think that weakens the book a little bit, weakens maybe our understanding of it a little bit. But let me suggest that the best way to understand what hevel is to work inductively, and that is to look at the vignettes that he tags as hevel and to see if we can find any patterns emerging. And in fact, this is what commentators normally do in their studies. It's not what they normally present in their commentaries necessarily, because you got to render the commentary into English. So let me offer you this handout. In which I have tried to summarize the gatherer's judgments about these different vignettes. Actually, I should retain one of those for myself.
Thank you.
And so once you get this, I should probably wait just for a minute and let this circulate around. Well, what you'll see on this handout, I'll go ahead and describe what it looks like for the sake of anyone listening to the recording who doesn't have access to it. What we have on the handout here is a list of situations that the gatherer tags in different ways using 3 different tags. Just focus for right now on this one that says hevel. And I invite you. I've tried to set up this. the structure of the handout so that you can make a note of what the terminology is in whichever translation you happen to use most often. Right? That's why you have that white section in the header. You can feel free to do that or not to do that, whatever's most helpful to you. But if you scan down the column that is headed by Hevel, you will see that the gatherer tags a lot of situations with this word Hevel. And then there's two others, and we'll get to those others here in a few minutes. We'll come back to those columns in a few minutes. In the far right-hand column, what I have tried to do is to categorize all of these situations into four general categories based on the outcomes that result from the different situations that that the gatherer observes. Now, you can potentially argue with my categories, with the classifications. We can tweak this in a number of different ways. I offer this to you as suggestive, as a possible way to organize some of the material in the book, or rather, to organize our thinking about the material in the book, not as, you know, this is what it is, but rather, let's try this on and see if it helps to illuminate what is happening in this book. So, the way I think about this, there are at least four overlapping categories that these Hevel situations fit into. So I've labeled them in this way. One category is the category of irresolvable outcomes, when the outcome of effort is irresolvable. What I mean by irresolvable, I just had to have one word, you know, that fit in that column. But what I mean by irresolvable is this: no matter how hard you try, it's never enough. No matter how hard you try, it's never enough. Now, there are examples of this in Kohelet, and I'll offer you one of his examples in just a minute, but let me just offer my own example that absolutely proves this point. Last time you did laundry, I bet you were wearing clothes.
Right?
And then what did you do with those clothes? You washed them later while you were wearing other clothes. Right? The laundry's never done. The dishes are never clean. You know, whatever it is. For the students, the semester is over, and then for me, it starts right up again. These kinds of cyclical things, irresolvable outcomes, no matter how hard you try, it is never enough. Now, the poem with which the gatherer opens the book gives us some good examples of that. The wind blows around the world, never stops. The sun goes up and down, round and round, never stops. The waters all flow to the sea, never ever stops. And I think that it's important to remember the sun and the wind, because these are important metaphorical hooks for the gatherer. Another example in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 7, the gatherer applies this to human life in this way. There are people who are utterly alone with no companions, not even a child or a sibling, yet they work hard without end, never satisfied with their wealth. Hashtag Hevel, hashtag Raha. Yeah, that's literally what it says there. This too is pointless and a terrible obsession, is what it says in my English text, but yeah, trust me. Hashtag. All right, so irresolvable outcomes. Number two, ephemeral outcomes. No matter what you do, it won't last. No matter what you do, it won't last. One example that he gives is in Ecclesiastes 5, 13 through 16. 13 through 16. I have seen a sickening tragedy under the sun. People hoard their wealth to their own detriment. Then that wealth is lost in a bad business venture, so that when they have children, they have nothing left. Just as they came from their mother's womb naked, naked they'll return, ending up just like they started. All their hard work produces nothing. Nothing they can take with them. Hashtag Ra'ah. They must pass on just as they arrive. What then? Where's the hashtag Yitron? It's not there. Right. So when the results of some effort are temporary, fleeting, fading, This is one of the categories that he tags as Hevel. A third category is when the outcomes are unexpected. Unexpected outcomes. No matter how well you prepare, the result is out of your control. No matter how well you prepare, the result is out of your control. And chapter 9 is probably the most famous place that we could go for this particular dimension of what it means to be Hevel. And I bet some of you could quote this from any number of translations, where the gatherer says, "The race doesn't always go to the swift, nor the battle to the mighty, nor food to the wise, nor wealth to the intelligent, nor favor to the knowledgeable, because accidents can happen to anyone." Right? So, if there is a case, the gatherer is really upset that sports betting makes any sense. Because sports betting only makes sense because upsets are possible. And upsets shouldn't be possible because the best team ought to win. The best athlete ought to win every time. Fastest runner ought to win every time. It doesn't happen that way in real life, and he knows this, and it troubles him to some extent. Now, as a corollary of unexpected outcomes, one sort of subcategory of unexpected outcomes are outcomes you can't control, right? Things that are out of your control. So let's just kind of note that as a footnote. And I think it's also kind of important in terms of chapter 9, 11, and 12, these unexpected outcomes, to also try to think about these situations from at least two perspectives. One is the perspective of an observer, of somebody watching the race, and also the perspective of the participant, somebody running the race. Because they may have very different expectations. When an upset happens in sports, people react in different ways, right? One team's happy and the other's not. One set of fans is happy and the other is not. But none of them were in complete control of what happened. And all of them were surprised because of the upset. And then the fourth category that I use on this handout is what I'm calling indiscriminate outcomes. Indiscriminate outcomes, meaning no matter who you are, it still all comes out the same. No matter who you are, it all comes out the same. And the parade example of that, pretty obviously, is... audience participation time? Is...
death.
Is death. Right. He says in chapter 9, verse 2, "Everything is the same for everyone. The same fate awaits the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the pure and the impure, those who sacrifice and those who don't sacrifice. The good person is like the wrongdoer. The same holds for those who make solemn pledges and those who are afraid to swear. This is the sad thing about all that happens under the sun. The same fate awaits everyone. And there's nothing you can do to change it." Right? Now, before you jump to resurrection and afterlife, let me remind you, you don't get to experience those until you die. Okay? And I'll just leave it at that, and we'll explore that a little bit more tomorrow. But there is, a step you got to take. Okay, so these are the situations that the gatherer labels as Hevel. And the common thread among them is that people cannot predict or nor control the future with any degree of certainty. All right? So I struggle to find an English word that respects the metaphorical nature of some of the gatherer's labels, that respects the terminology he uses, and I've tried to find it by linking the hashtag Hevel with the other two hashtags that are shown on the handout. Now, our time is growing short, and so I will try to explain this just as quickly as I can, so it doesn't really spill over to tomorrow. But you'll see that after Hevel, the next column is labeled with some funny-looking words, both of which have the word ruach, or wind, in them, a couple of different phrases. If you're wondering what that little hook thing is, it is a voiced pharyngeal fricative. Whoa, baby, if you want to know what a voiced pharyngeal fricative is, see me after class. Those two words are pronounced something like ra'ut ru'ach and ra'yom ru'ach. And it is very hard to know what they mean because The first word in those word pairs could be derived from any of six different roots that are spelled exactly the same way. Don't they fool? We can really, for practical purposes, kind of narrow it down. Let me ask you to take a quick look at Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 14, the first place in the book where this appears. The CEB reads like this: "When I observe all that happens under the sun, I realize that everything is pointless." A what? CEB says, chasing after wind. What else do we have in a representative room? NIV says something like chasing after wind. KJV says vexation of spirit, which sounds like it should be a Brian Eno song. What else do we have?
Striving
after wind or something like that, okay. Any other examples?
Pursuit of the wind.
Okay. So there's two primary possibilities for what this word how this word derives. It may derive from the word for shepherding, for what a shepherd does to the sheep. Okay? Tending the flock, feeding the flock. Sometimes what a shepherd does is described in different language as following the flock. Like God says to David, "I took you from following the flock, and I made you king over Israel." So this is where we get the chasing or the after the wind idea, that he's following like a shepherd might follow sheep. The second big possibility is that it derives from the word, that a Hebrew verb that means to associate with, and is the word, so we get the word neighbor, one of the words for neighbor from that. Like in the Exodus, you know, when they left in the Exodus and each woman asked her re'ut to give her gold and silver, her friend. So it could mean a pursuit of the wind, like you're trying to herd the wind. It can also mean it's a friend of the wind. It's blowing in the wind. Right? So very difficult for us to try to represent that in just one, all those possibilities in just one English word. Now, the third, so you know where to find your English equivalent of hevel in your Bible, chapter 1, verse 2. You know where to find the English equivalent of re'ut, ruach in your Bible, the end of chapter 1, verse 14. The third column is the most difficult of all. The word ra'ah, sorry, I didn't do my voice pharyngeal fricative properly. This is the word, so chapter 1, verse 13, it's a blank that God has given to human beings. It's a blank. What does your Bible say after that? Mine says it's an unhappy business. Chapter 1, verse 13. You probably have some different noun and adjective combination. Heavy burden.
Bothersome task.
All right. In most places, this word is translated in English as evil. Evil. The word evil in Hebrew has this very, very wide range. So Darth Vader is evil. The volcano is too. Hitler is evil, but an earthquake is too. And so it's got this very, very broad range. So you might look at 1:13. You might look at 2:17. All the things that happen under the sun are blank to me. Chances are it's a different word than what you saw in the previous verse. And our translators really struggle with this. So let me see if I can tie all this together in 90 seconds or less and set us up for where we go then tomorrow. So what I have tried to do in my own thinking about this, and I offer it to you now, is to try to understand these three hashtags in conversation with each other. Because it seems clear to me when I lay it out on the page like this, it seems really clear to me that that the gatherer is using and choosing these terms in a way to create this kind of three-way back and forth between them, this kind of triangulation between them. Because the first word, you look at the middle column, the one that's got two words in it, in the phrase, so the re'ut ruach, that the root word, the one that means either shepherding or to be an associate or to be a friend of, that is spelled exactly like the word in the next column. It doesn't mean the same thing, but it's spelled exactly alike. And I think the gatherer wants us to know that and wants us to hear that. And this is why we should teach Hebrew students to pronounce voice pharyngeal fricatives instead of taking the lazy way that we always do and making it a silent letter. But he wants us to know that that relationship is there. There's something going on. There is wordplay going on here. This man is a master rhetorician, David Holmes. And you know that. And so I think there's a link there. And then Ruach. Now we're coming back to this word, hevel. Ruach, I mentioned before, is well established that that means wind or breath or spirit. Now what's interesting about hevel is that everywhere outside of Ecclesiastes, it means one of two things. It either means an idol, or it means, wait for it, wind or breath. What do you know? So, and by the way, it means idol in the narrative or historical books, and it means wind or breath in the poetical and wisdom books almost perfectly. There's a little bit of exception in Psalms, but almost perfectly it breaks down that way. So the books that hang out with Job over there, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, they all use hevel in the sense of breath. So that's why I was so excited to hear that the message uses smoke. Because that's a great word. And it's great also because it's a noun. Now, I went in a different direction on the handout, and you'll see on the bottom of page 2 that I suggested foggy. Because it's, frankly, easier to use an adjective in some of the English sentences. Foggy. Okay, but here's the thing about fog. Now, you can get fog. We drove through fog this morning. Last night, going home, right? I'm saying right to my wife, Renee, who's sitting right there, and she was there for the fog, and I commented on how this fit into the class. But I've taken about 60 to 90 seconds more than I'm supposed to, but let me just say, foggy reminds me of the four different topic categories that I mentioned before, all rolled up in one adjective. And it reminds me that wind and breath are an important motif in this book. Because fog, what does fog do? It obscures your sight. But it doesn't hang around very long. It burns off as the day goes on. But then it's back the next day. And, you know, I don't care how good your eyesight is, that fog's going to block you. If I have my glasses on or off, doesn't matter. Fog can affect me the same way. So to me, words related to wind are useful to try to substitute. So one of the things that I try to do when I read this book, when I see pointless, I just say, no, not pointless, foggy. When I see these, you know, wind chasing, I try to make it a little bit more general, vaporous or something like that. And this ra'ah word, this word often translated as evil or an unhappy business or a great misfortune or whatever, I try in my own mind to replace that with exasperating. This takes your breath away. Because this reminds me of this thread that's running through this book. Okay, that's what's wrong with our world. That's what's wrong with our world. Stuff didn't work like the gatherer would like it to work. All right, the four reasons that I mentioned before. Tomorrow, what we will do is we will start by, I'll pick up right there and I'll try to explain from the gatherer's point of view why the world does this. Why does the world exasperate us so much? And then his prescription for what we should do about it. And then we'll try to set that into the context of Christian theology, because this guy is several centuries pre-Christian. Right? And so we'll try to wrap that up with a bookend. And then we'll hand it off to David for it. Right. Thank you so much. If you have questions about what we talked about today, I encourage you maybe to write them down for me and hand them to me today so I can try to answer them tomorrow, or to save them for tomorrow, where I will try to manage my time better and leave more time for discussion and question near the end. Is that okay? I hope so, because we have to yield the room to other people. Yes, certainly. And the email address would be, you can also tweet at me if you want. Fallon would be so happy. chird@pepperdine.edu or Dr. C. Hurd on Twitter. And if you'll tag, PBL2017 or whatever the hashtag is, then everybody will get to see. Thank you so much, y'all. We must yield the room to the next group. But I really look forward to sharing the second half of this with you tomorrow.